So you're going to hear from me again. Again, I'm Donna Fick from Penn State College of Nursing, and about non-farm. And the challenge I give to you is at the end of this conference or at the end of this boot camp, for us to think of another name.
Yes.
That. We're going to take a minute. So that's why I put, and I don't know that I like any of those, but I'm going to make the case that non-farm is the wrong thing for us to be calling it for several reasons. I'm going to review a little bit of the background, maybe less so because a lot of this early work is based on what Sharon just shared with you today, but I will make that point again. I am going to talk about single versus multi-component because I agree with Sharon that the evidence shows us that multi-components, not just in delirium but in dementia, work best. But I think it's very important for us to continue to not just test, think about single components, but think about which components work the best and the strongest and what dose and duration and strength those should be. And then I'm going to close with some methodological issues for you to think about as you design these types of studies and then what some novel areas or gaps might be. So what's good for the heart is good for the brain, is good for delirium, and also what's good for delirium is good for falls and functional decline. These are just a couple of examples of what I have to think of something besides non-drug. I'm going to say eco-biopsychosocial interventions can do, and also make a point that there are some that are emerging where we really have very little evidence, but the evidence is starting to. In a few trials, things like bright light therapy, things like dancing. I don't know if any of you, there's a couple of small studies and case studies that's done with dancing, with square dancing actually, even with dementia, with delirium, and with music therapy, and all areas that are complex to study. So again, non-farm, what exactly is it and what do we know about it? I hope to leave you with this afternoon's that we definitely need more evidence in this area. This is a area, and that's why we're going to talk about some of these issues with fidelity in particular, is that this is an area that we often end up with studies that are underpowered or not well designed because of not paying attention to some of these issues and have high biases. So we definitely need you to be doing more studies in this area. And again, arose by any other name, is that I would go to the point to say that in the delirium field we're behind because nobody in the dementia field uses this term anymore. So let's think today about a different way to approach this. This is one of the reasons why is that there are several studies, I think just in this October, Esther O and colleagues, including Sharon, published an article in JAMA Review. There's a whole series there. I think Ed has a paper in there too that looked at the evidence for drugs. And I think they looked at like 19 different studies. This also looked at 19 studies, showed that the evidence for antipsychotic drugs is conflicting and can also cause harm. So again, we need to stop putting the emphasis on drugs by calling it non-drugs and think about a different term. So I was going to take a little bit of time to talk about the basis of the early approach, but Sharon addressed this. Is that this is really everything that has stemmed from this very early careful work on these six risk factors that were paired in this trial, being cognitive impairment, sleep deprivation, immobility, visual impairment, hearing impairment, and dehydration. And again, a 9% versus 15% reduction in delirium. But since that time, there have been a number of non-drug studies. These drug studies are increasing. I'm going to talk about a couple of those. This is an interesting small study from Chris Wozinski. We don't see a lot of nursing studies, but thinking about the issue of the increasing use of technology in behavioral interventions. And in this study, Chris Wozinski looked at using simulated family presence at the bedside with televideo to decrease agitation in persons with delirium was able to do that. So there's a lot of different technology and different approaches coming out there too. This looked at systematic review, and again, similar to what we just heard, that prevention is where it's at, and they found really the treatment that there was no, in this pooled analysis of studies, they found that there was no impact on treatment. Again, a meta-analysis of 14 trials from 1999 to 2013, over 4,000 acute medical and surgical patients, all studies adapted for help. They had a 53, and again, these, you've heard about these, but these were the risk factors that were targeted. It's a little bit out of sync in there, sorry, is that the odds of delirium reduced by 53%. The other thing that is interesting about this is that 11 out of the 14 studies decreased delirium, but two of the trials decreased falls. So that's the other thing to keep importance. And when we talk about translation into the clinical setting, when I, again, with the age-friendly health system, is that these are the kind of things that also makes health system people perk up their ears. When you talk about many of these trials have not just an impact on delirium, but things like falls. These are actually slides from Karen Newfield and Dale Needham, but just showing you some of these things, because I know how many of you do ICU research? Yes, yeah, so a lot of you. So over at least 25%. Maybe 30% of the people in this group. But these are what is, just to make the point, that many of these same kind of things are being done in the ICU setting, and we need more of that work. But this is, again, from Karen and Dale, what some of these things look like in the ICU setting, reading the newspaper, enjoying Sudoku, walking outside of the ICU with, as you can see, lots of tethers and restraints and invasive devices. Again, in this showed that doing these sort of things can reduce delirium by 53%. What am I going to say about this? Oh, I was just going to point out for those of you that, if you haven't seen this, to look at this, because it's a particularly important review if you're writing your proposals, is because they looked at 127 articles, 25 were clinical trials, 42 cohort studies, 5 systematic reviews, and looked at not just non-pharmacological interventions, but the drug trials and also the data on assessment tools, including the 3D CAM. So this is a great, if you're right now writing those proposals, this is an important NICE review that just came out in JAMA in October. Again, looking at the, in detail, all the non-pharmacologic approaches to delirium prevention, including orientation, fluid repletion, early mobilization, feeding assistance, vision and hearing. And one of the things that I'm going to talk about a little bit when I talk about some of the areas of need, and again, I see this with the age-friendly health system, is testing out more specificity with each of these components, and maybe Sharon can talk about that, is, for instance, what kind of fluid repletion is most helpful in a practical way on the bedside, how much, how it should be delivered. So even though I think we've done a lot of work on showing that these, what happens when they're translated into practice is they're not always translated into a way that has specificity in order for them to work in the real setting. So it may seem simple, but it's really not. We really need prevention trials that look at these different components in a more specific and more precise way. So again, a couple more things about multi-component versus single is, as Sharon pointed out, the evidence from both delirium and dementia studies and systematic reviews show that a combination approach, a multi-component approach, is more potent. Delirium, of course, is often multi-component causal, but a single component is cleaner and easier to say it worked or did not work, and often it also gives us greater specificity in terms of okay, this is the fluid, this is the exact fluid repletion that you need to deliver, this is the dosage that you need, and this is the duration. We haven't seen that kind of specificity in many of the multi-components. The other thing, and I'll show you an example in a moment, is that the multi-component approach, at least in terms of 6 or 7 risk factors, is not always realistic in the practice setting. There's an example of 2 trials we did at Penn State that you can find on clinicaltrials.gov. And this is was published in JAMS in 2016. And we were not, this is, again, speaks to before this was over 283 individuals in 8 post-acute care facilities, a single-blind randomized controlled trial. And we delivered tailored cognitive stimulation for individuals that had delirium and went into post-acute care. So again, not a prevention trial, but a treatment trial. And we delivered for up to 30 days. But the thing that about this that was more precise was that these individuals had not just cognitive and neuropsych testing, but the cognitive stimulation was tailored to their, like, their mini mental state score and their mental status testing. It was also tailored to their leisure interests. So if we knew that they were, you know, a psychology professor or a banker or a farmer, their cognitive stimulation was tailored to that. We were not able to impact the number of delirium-free days, but we did improve executive function and length of stay in the post-acute care setting. But again, this is an example of a single-component, multi-component trial. The protocol for this is also published in Trials Journal. And if you are looking at an example of a fidelity plan, that's a good example. This is an example of a multi-component, but it's a multi-component with targeting only 3 risk factors, and this is, again, unusual, I think, in a lot of the trials that you'll see. And this was a cluster randomized controlled trial that was clustered by wards with 377 individuals, and they were able to decrease delirium by 6% versus 15. And this they called MHELP, or modified HELP, and it targeted just 3 protocols. And I actually might ask Sharon, because I wonder why they picked these 3. But I mean, they give some background. But the 3 protocols were orienting and communication, oral and nutritional mobility. And this was delivered by trained nurses. The mobility I get and the communication I probably get if it's persons with dementia, but I just wondered why they, do you know?
This was by Dr. Cheryl Chen, also from Yale. She had this belief that the nutrition was, of course, part of health, but she really believed that the oral hygiene would assist with the recovery of the gut. It didn't turn out to really show that, but she has a great belief in oral care, so
yeah, sure.
That's why she chose that. And she thought those 3 were most likely to be able to be done by nurses within the context of the daily routine of their care.
Right, so this is a good example of a multi-component, but a multi-component that targets a limited number of risk factors. And again, I'll say this in a minute when I talk about areas where I think we need more research, is I think we still have an issue with our multi-component trials, not as much with our single component, but definitely with the multi-component, is having a level of specificity of you know, why those 3 were chosen, what the dosage should be, what the duration should be, and again, so for many reasons, but one of the big ones is so that it can be translated into practice and we can improve care of older adults. So I'm going to talk about a couple of these issues. These are all issues that when you're writing an ego biopsychosocial intervention study that you should address. And those are the premise and the underlying mechanism. So why you chose those 3 components, or those 6 components, or that single component. Pilot testing, very, very important. We'll talk about that. fidelity, which I think is talked about a lot, but often not done in a way that's measurable, and dosage and strength and duration, which is all part of fidelity. Training and standing standardization for the intervention, just the person who does the treatment. And also, I don't remember if I say a lot more about this, but this is a good thing for question and answer and lunch, is the very practical issues, startup issues of site agreements, multiple IRBs, having relationships with your sites, knowing what it takes to really get in there into the setting, and we can talk more about that. So I want to say that doing a pilot study is critical. How many are doing intervention studies versus others? Okay, not that many, but that's probably because you're just as Sharon described, you're starting, you're building the science, perhaps building towards that. But even if you're not doing intervention study, no matter what kind of study you're doing, this is relevant to you, that doing a pilot study is critical. I would tell you not to really put in any external grant until you've done that. And even if it's just five people. Again, I say up here, we did 15 for our first RO1, 16 for our second RO1. Ed and I have a study together, and we do 23, 24, that we just, that was just accepted for the Journal of Gerontological Nursing. So every study I do, you do a pilot study for. And when you do that, you pilot as many components as possible. And really what you're looking to do with a pilot in some ways is to fail, is to look for those pitfalls and know what the alternatives are, to work out those practical issues so you can say to the NIH or to the National Health Service, wherever you're at, and say, look, we can recruit. We know exactly what our pool of people with dementia and delirium is that we're going after. We have relationships with the IRB. We can do all these things. And then you also want to find out, okay, the way I said I was going to deliver that doesn't really work, or this measurement that I thought was going to work isn't appropriate here. So you want, again, even if it's 5, 10, or 15 people, you want to do it so you can figure out what the pitfalls are and then approach what your alternative will be. And it's also the beginning of, the other thing it does is it makes you get a start on things like procedure manuals, training, videos for training in the sites, if it's an intervention study or for assessment. So why care about treatment fidelity? Treatment fidelity really is, particularly if you have an intervention study, whether your intervention study works, sometimes it does, or it doesn't, you want to be able to make sure that your fidelity is true so that you can say those results are both reliable and valid. And what often happens is we'll have a study, might have a study that works, but we're really not sure it worked because the intervention may have been some other things, or we have a study that didn't work because we didn't deliver the intervention as it was intended. So again, it tells you if the treatment was delivered, it impacts study validity. And then this is another big one, is it helps with implementation and translation into practice. So the examples that I gave is, you know, if you published the cluster RCT and say, okay, I have three protocols here. They're oral hydration and nutrition, their mobility, and their communication, but you have no fidelity logs about it. So you can come, you know, particularly with any of them, you know, nurses, both nurses and physicians are certainly know what it's like to deliver oral care or nutrition or mobility, but they may not know how to translate this into the practice and make it into protocols for it to really make a difference with the person with delirium. So you need to be able to say, okay, this is the dosage that you need, this is the duration, this is how you can implement it into practice. You also don't, whether it's assessment or intervention, you want them to be delivering it. So development of things like, here's a training video that we used to do the actual study, and you can also use this in practice. So it's a really important piece. Again, it ensures the same treatment, dose, number, frequency, The example here, again, was from our reserve study, is that we had very careful timing of all the cognitive stimulation. So we knew what exactly was that dose that was delivered that was able to make an impact. Or if you, again, if you don't have positive results, is it because your intervention was interrupted, which happens, right? So you're, all of us are doing this within the context of clinical practice. So if you're not monitoring these things, you don't know, or maybe you didn't have positive results because every time they went in to do the intervention, they were interrupted by something. And so these are really very real things that you need to measure. It ensures equivalent dose across conditions or sites. So the example that I'll give for this, and I think Ed might have an example of this too from his cluster RCT, is that we are in the process now of writing up the results for cluster RCT, early nurse detection of delirium superposed dementia. We were definitely able to impact. We increased nurse recognition of delirium. We decreased the use of psychoactive medications, but we didn't impact the delirium rate. But one of the things that we did see is, even though we thought we had the same intervention across sites, is that we had a large academic medical center, we had a regional medical center, and then a local community hospital, which has its own kind of diversity, but that it was much harder to impact some of the other settings. So we felt like we were delivering the same dose, but we really weren't, because we were getting interrupted, or we were not listened to, or not. So that, you know, that those kind of things, if you aren't measuring them, and we were, so we were able to say something about that, but if you aren't measuring them, particularly in large cluster RCTs, then you're not sure why you didn't have an impact. This may be a little harder to read, but this is strategies for provider training for Fidelity. So things like standardizing training. So making sure that you have standardized patients for them to do a checklist on, that you have written pre and post training, things like videos. So you want to minimize drift. So not only do you ensure that you are measuring the intervention, but you also want to go in and do booster sessions. So all these things to minimize drift and to accommodate provider differences if your intervention is being delivered by a provider. This is comes from Kalinowski 2006 article. This is just an example, and I actually cut it off so you don't see all of it. But again, it's important not just to talk about Fidelity, but to actually have a Fidelity check. It's an older paper, but a lot of this comes from a 2004 work group, the NIH Behavior Change Consortium. And even though it's about behavior intervention research, it applies very much to delirium. These are the recommendations. So a couple other tips, and I think I've talked about this a little bit, but thinking about, and Wes may touch on this too, but thinking about, again, designing with implementation in mind, and that's part of my stressing Fidelity. Thinking about the pros and cons of doing academic medical centers. And if some of you have heard me talk, you've probably heard me say that before, but you know, one of the things we don't want to do is do all of our studies within academic medical centers and then try to translate them into the community. So we want to make sure that we have some diversity there. Because in my opinion, that's why a lot of them fail. And again, I see that with the age-friendly healthcare system, is that initiative is that you implement these in large health system where a lot of people already know about delirium, where there's 10 geriatricians, or there's geriatric clinical nurse specialists, and that's not where most older adults receive their care. You want to think about cost. I think the last three R01s that I've had or been involved in, all of them have had health economists. So the health economists, not just to say delirium is a $164 billion problem, but to say, what does it cost to deliver your intervention? What does it cost if a nurse aide delivers your intervention versus a registered nurse versus a physician? But maybe a physician does it more accurately, and they're worth the cost, or maybe a nurse versus a nurse aide. So having a health economist help you think about all those kind of issues, because those, again, have a lot to do with translation. And then also, testing my area in particular that I have a lot of interest in is delirium superimposed on dementia. And we know that dementia is the biggest independent risk factor for delirium. I'll say that again, it's the largest independent risk factor for delirium. And as Sharon showed, we're actually still trying to untangle and understand that relationship. I'd say that's pretty true. That's an area that we still really don't understand. So making sure that you're in your, all of your studies, but in your intervention studies too, that you're testing across severity and types of impairment. How many of you went to the, or listened to the 2017 Dementia Summit? Anybody? No DSD people in here? Marie did, thanks Marie. So I actually wasn't there in person because I had other meetings, but there are a couple things that came out from the Dementia Summit that I thought were relevant to delirium work. And again, this is probably because I do interventions for delirium superimposed on dementia, but thinking about co-design, and I think Wes stepped out of the room, but Wes, Alessandro Morandi from Italy, but several individuals have done a lot of work in looking at the suffering of delirium, so how in talking with people after they experience delirium, and not just people without dementia, but also delirium superimposed on dementia. So talking with them about what that experience is like, what the burden of testing is like for people with dementia and delirium. So co-designing your studies to make sure you're decreasing the burden and addressing those issues. The use of language, removing academic jargon, making research relevant. Again, this one I think Sharon and I both addressed, but again, in the dementia literature also, this issue of not just multi-component, but which components, when combined together, are the most potent, have the biggest impact, so thinking about that. So apparently, when we're done tonight, we should all go out and trail run while doing serial sevens, because that'll make you sharp tomorrow. The other is home care is the missing link. How many of you are doing home care in delirium or community-based long-term care? Marie? I thought I read some other proposals for that, but maybe it was the junior group camp. And then Jason Carlo, probably many of you know from Penn, talked about the ethics of balancing relevance, co-design, and rigor. The fact that we shouldn't do any of this co-design unless it's rigorous. Just as another area that I think is big is understanding this issue between delirium superimposed on dementia and the overlap with. By the way, this term is also going out, so a lot of people don't use that one. But this issue of behavioral problems. So the reason it's going out is because it says that behavior is a problem, but behavior is really not a problem. Behavior is a good thing. It usually has meaning, and many times it means delirium. So figuring out this overlap in syndromes and also the overlap of how we would address that in intervention studies. So whether or not people with delirium and dementia will benefit from different kinds of interventions because of their dementia and because of this issue of PPSD. Some other gaps, I think, are thinking about outcomes that are more distal to delirium. Again, conducting interventions in community, and not just community, but across the transition. So we know that that prevention works best, but for individuals that get delirium and go to post-acute care or go home, what kind of intervention, what kind of way should we be intervening? Novel methods, and I'm really glad Marie's going to address this today, because thinking about mixed methodologies, not just I'm going to do a quantitative study and I'm going to do a qualitative, but thinking about how they inform each other and how they help us answer some of these difficult questions. How many of you have heard of the most of the SMART designs? Rich, good. So I think I have another slide. I'll talk about that. The MOST design actually comes out of Penn State with Linda Collins, and I think this has promise for us thinking about, particularly with the multi-component studies, about thinking about which components would be most helpful, which components are most impactful. Capturing the impact of multiple chronic conditions, and again, involving stakeholders, which I've talked about. This is MOST, which stands for the Multi-Phase Optimization Strategy. And the goal, this started with behavior intervention research like smoking cessation. And a lot of the early literature has to do with prevention and smoking cessation, but it's moving into these kind of interventions. It's thinking about the briefest intervention that achieves a minimal level of effectiveness. So thinking about how you can use approaches like MOST or SMART to think about your intervention design. Other novel research questions, which we can talk about, are emerging technology-based interventions with smartphones and apps. And there's a couple of those. There's a study in 2012 by Melinda Stice where she did the fan cam using a smartphone app. And then special populations. So this is the other thing I learned from the Dementia Summit is about 30% of persons with dementia live alone. So how many people with dementia and delirium are living alone that we're sending out? And also that we often, of course, children, how many people do PEDS? Any people? Great, so a couple of you, not all of them there. So thinking about special populations like children and surgical, and also those with intellectual disabilities. So for instance, people with Down syndrome are over 30% increased risk of having dementia, and those individuals experience delirium, but we often exclude people with intellectual disabilities in our delirium studies. So thinking about these people that not only are a special population, but often live alone or without support, and how can we intervene with them? Again, technology I just talked about. So thinking also about this, not just thinking about community as home care, post-acute care, long-term care, but how we design interventions that go across settings. So I'll close with these recommendations because I think I'm getting the 5-minute warning. This is a pilot. Don't put anything in without a pilot. The other piece about a pilot is no one's gonna give you $250,000 or $50,000 or $500,000 unless you show that you can do it and you show that you can publish it. So piloting with publishing is your currency for bigger grants. Paying attention to those practical aspects, and I think you do that through piloting. Such as procedure manuals, fidelity checks, measurement logs. Thinking about where we have gaps in the evidence, and you'll probably think of some more, perhaps, that I missed. And then considering some of these novel approaches and methods, particularly mixed methods, which you'll hear a lot more about this afternoon. If anyone wants any of these papers or citations, just email me. And remember, it's not about you, it's about the cow, and you can ask me about that at lunch. And those cows I run past every morning. And that most everything that I've learned is either from Ed, Sharon, or making a mistake. And Beth. And these are my children, and the only way to do great work is to not only make mistakes, but have fun doing it. So love what you do. And have it show and have fun for the next couple of days. Thank you. And I think I have a couple of minutes for questions. Yeah.